Are there any questions or anything to share? So I'd like to talk about circulation, and I want to start with a really basic question. It's easy. So if something in the body falls asleep, like if I would sit, let's say, like this for a while, my leg would fall asleep, which is why I put this. And then when the meditation is over, how many times I did that before someone showed me the pillow trick. Sitting the 45 minutes with the leg asleep and then, okay, here we go. I remember the first time I came to India and the second time I was in Bodh Gaya, and we did some Zen practice in one of the Zen temples there, and we sat in the temple inside, like the barrier between the pilgrims who come in and put their donations, between that barrier and the sort of statues or whatever. And so it was a little bit like performing while meditating and being 20 at the same time. It was a little bit of pressure. And we were supposed to sit and immediately stand up and immediately take these little tiny steps in a circle. 20-year-olds, not bursting out laughing and so on. Much less falling over, which I did. Because my leg was asleep, and I had to stand up, and I couldn't, and I fell. And the monk was like angry with me. Get up! All in the name of Dharma. So just to describe the feeling when the leg wakes up, tell me. That's my really easy question for today.
It's kind of delicious and excruciating at the same time.
A little louder. A little louder.
It's delicious and excruciating at the same time.
Okay, why not? Delicious and excruciating, which means delicioso and excruciating. Like to an extreme of pain. I'm not sure where it comes from, excruciating, like cross and out of the cross. I don't know where. I know what you mean. Okay, but more specific, like the physical sensation.
It's pins and needles.
Yeah, we call it pins and needles in English. So what does that mean?
Physical pricking.
Physical pricking.
But the blood obviously started to circulate again.
Well, that's what we think. I guess so. But it's curious, the feeling doesn't at all match what I would imagine blood circulating to feel like. What else? So it feels like...
Electricity. It's kind of numb as well, isn't it, if you try to stand up?
Yeah.
On it, then you can't.
So there's high contrast between numb and like little stabbing and tingling and electricity. Okay. I'm getting happy, maybe a little bit more.
Seems to come in waves.
Waves. Yeah. I experienced that also.
You can make it go away quicker by actually putting pressure on or moving it rather than mm-hmm. keeping it still.
Right. Good trick.
Yeah.
Could you hear?
A little bit like it doesn't belong to you.
Yeah. Also.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's the numbness or the intensity contrast or what, but yeah. Cool. Any more? I feel like we have a couple more to go.
Sensation of ice.
Ice, yeah. Hot and cold is what I feel. Again, it's like as if the system's like contrast, hot and cold, trying to guess what we're feeling. Is it hot and cold? Is it ice and fire? Good. Maybe
it's heavy and also like a pulsating.
Yeah.
And it feels separate from me a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. Why do you think it feels separate? Any clue?
It's got disconnected. I don't know. Like it kind of is. I mean, it's weird. It's this weird gap of like feeling, not feeling, and it's weird.
Yeah, it is weird. Yeah. Cool, good. I think that's pretty complete now. Any other?
Contraction. It's like heavy contraction.
Yeah, that's true. Like cramping even.
Mm-hmm.
Literally can be. But yeah. It's again like opening and closing at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Good. Okay.
Isn't it a pinched nerve rather than a question of circulation?
I don't know.
Mm-hmm. I think so.
Maybe.
If it was circulation, you'd really be in trouble.
Yeah.
It would be blue. It would be blue or black. I have no idea. That's why I said we think of it as blood. I think of it as blood going back in, but it doesn't feel like that. It doesn't feel like flow. So maybe it's just the nerve. Just.
It's amazing how quick it gets alive again. In the beginning, I'm just sometimes I'm afraid, but I think, it's dead.
Yeah. Good.
Quite.
Yeah.
Fast. As
yeah.
Okay, it's fine.
And it seems, even though it is quite fast, in the time, it feels like it's taking a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it's only a few seconds, like
yeah.
maybe 30. Sometimes a little more, sometimes a little less, but it's true, it's quite quick. And it, in the process feels, there's enough time to think, maybe I'll never walk again. What was that, sorry?
It's, nothing stays, like it's gone. Like
yeah.
Gone.
Yeah, if anything stays, then please come talk to me. Cool. Great. So I mentioned in the last retreat an Israeli woman who teaches yoga and dharma, really, named Orit Sen Gupta. This is one of her delicious books. It's called The Heart of Practice. Understanding yoga from the inside. And she talks about noticing students that come to classes of yoga for years. They keep coming and they don't listen. But they keep coming. And she said that they can, it's not that they're necessarily anti-teacher. She said they can be really pleasant and everything. But like really strictly not listening, especially usually to certain things, certain areas. And she can watch the gap growing over the years between them and the other students who are listening in the certain areas. She calls them the non-listeners. And she regrets later on now, she regrets when she used to try to insist that they listen. She used to really go in and try to really correct the posture or the alignment or the rhythm or whatever. She says they might be pleasant, but they're not willing to let the teacher interfere with their understanding of what is taught. I think it's a great phrasing. So that we can feel that happening. It happens in us, in all of us. Where we're not willing to let something interfere with our understanding of something. And so she says, she allows them, as long as they're not hurting themselves, she allows them to not listen. She feels respect for the resistance. She said that there are so many layers in the body and the mind that may need their own timing. One of my teachers is sort of famous for being really direct and energetic and giving people intense experience. He's no longer living, so don't sort of think that you can get your ticket for the intense experience. But when he met people privately, different things came out. And one of my friends has had quite traumatic experience as a child. And she spoke to him about this. And though he was an 80-year-old Indian, former wrestler, former army, former miner, hardcore kind of person, he simply answered, "Some things take time." And this is a man who was like, "There's no time. All you need is half a second to give to yourself." No, half a second. No, half the half. And to her, he said, "Some things take time." And he gave her a mantra. One time it became known that there was such a thing as Atma, which could be called self. And sometimes it's used for individual and sometimes it's used for like big. Unborn, undying. And so there were two teams at the time. There were the demons and the gods. And they both wanted to get, because it was said that if you got this, if you got the teaching and understood it, then you would win immortality. And because there was this sense of these two teams, there was a sense that if you got it, you got it for your team. So your team would win immortality. So there's all kinds of things that we can get ridiculous about, including immortality. And so the demons elected Vairochana, who was a son of the sun in the sky, one of many, to go for them, like their ambassador. And the gods, of course, sent Indra, who was like the head of the gods. Not always a very smart guy, but a leader type. And so Indra and Vairochana went to Prajapati, who was this lonely creator. He was the first thing to happen. And from him came everything, according to the stories. And they went with all of their eagerness to get the prize and asked him to give the teachings of Atma. To feel what might be so important about what is Atma, we can tune into questions like, what is this? Or what is real? And we notice during the days on retreat how much isn't real, how much is completely fabricated, completely additional. And we get interested in feeling what is. What isn't additional. And sometimes there grows an energy in that. And we might try to find where everything comes from, where the source of creation, Prajapati, and ask for some help. And in this case, Prajapati didn't say a word for 5 years. Just 5 years. Not even a single word, not like maybe later or get out of here, or there was nothing to push or pull against. He said nothing. And they lived there, and in the Indian way, they served him also for 5 years without a single remark from him. And finally, I sort of imagine him, because he was lonely. He got all of his creations abandoned him. They went off to live their lives, and he was just like there. I imagine him a bit sort of gruff, like, all right, what do you want? You haven't come back to be with me. You come back to ask for something. Okay, what do you want? Kids. So after the 5 years, he agreed to talk to them. And he said, this person, this so-called person, this Atma, or we could just say this without the word person, might be more clear for us today. This that one sees here in the eye, so this eye, not the letter I, but the E-Y-E-O-E-I-L, I, O-E-O-J-O, I. This that one sees in the eye, that is the self, the Atman, that is the immortal, so that is what is deathless and unborn. That is the one free from fear. That is Brahman, which is a word for the ultimate. It also has the sense of and the root meaning of expansiveness. So, in the sense of already infinite, already limitless, and also expanding, an ongoing, a process of infinity. Brahman. So it's quite a simple answer, very compact. This person, or this that one sees in the eye, he asked them to look in their at their reflection in the water after he says this. This that one sees in the eye is that that doesn't die, that that has no fear, that that already is without limit and continues to explore infinity. Look at yourselves in the water, what do you see? And his students look and they say, sir, we see our entire body Atman, a perfect likeness to ourselves. We see the exact reflection down to the fingernails. That's what we see. Then Prajapati has them dress up and get all fancy. And he asked them to look again at their reflection in the water. What do you see? And they say, sir, as the two of us here are perfectly adorned, so are those reflected in the water. And then Prajapati is being, I think, a little bit tricky here in the answering and saying, that is the immortal. That is the one free from fear. That is Brahman. Because he can tell they're looking at the dress rather than the eye. But he's said enough for them to go on, but he's not stopping there the way that they've gone off track. And so then watch what happens. So Vairochana, the ambassador of the demons, is all happy. He's like, got it. And he goes back to his team, goes happily to the demons, and teaches them that Atma is what you see when you look into the water. So he forgets to give the actual teaching. kind of cute. And so when our minds drive us crazy and do things like that, we could see how cute it is. Like, so willing to ignore the deeper teaching and be happy with the sort of decoration. Indra also starts to go back towards home, towards heaven, towards his team. But he's still thinking about the answer. And he thinks, well, what's reflected in the water can't be Atman. So he's not too bright, but he does manage to like make that thought. Sorry, Indra. He's heavily armed. And very proud. Oh dear. Hopefully he has a sense of humor today. So he goes back and he's still thinking. So there's basically this little doubt. So in the Zen tradition, they talk about small doubt and great doubt, but I think we need to have a third kind. I think there's like dense doubt, which is what the Zen tradition means by small doubt, where we'd think, oh, I'll never be able to get to the answer, for example. I'm not ever going to know what Atman is. Or there can't be such a thing as Atman. If I don't get it, if I can't understand it, it must not exist. I mean, that's what we do every day. Our pride. I have a friend who was a very fast runner in her high school years, Indian princess, actually, literally. And she went to the finals, the championship of whatever, I don't know if it was the state or all of India in her age. Not runner, jumper. She did the long jump. And she lost. Like, someone else jumped farther than she did. And she could not believe that she lost. And so she didn't. Even the judges decided there had to be a double gold medal because she could not lose. I'm serious. So sometimes we might feel really small and like, oh, I'll never make it. But to feel for that other side, this like, it can't exist if I don't experience it. So dense doubt is sort of really heavy. And then the small doubt is where we kind of smell something is going on. And maybe just because I don't have an explanation, there's still something going on that's worthwhile. And then great doubt would be like when we're really on fire with the questions, in some way, not necessarily words, like what is this? So I think we need really a lot of this middle, which I like to call little doubt. So not small doubt, but little. It's just little, it's not very big. It's just a little. Like on the last retreat, I gave this example where a couple of weeks ago, they call it a dwarf planet. It's really a big ball of ice that's pink, a big asteroid has been discovered. And it's way, way out. And its orbit goes through areas of the solar system that we thought were empty. We still think are empty. But the shape of the orbit shows there must be something. And so it's this kind of like, that's a weird orbit. You know, like we thought there was no planet. Wow, there's a dwarf planet, asteroid. 2014 VP113. Until we get to know her better. And just that, like, that's a weird orbit where it kind of flashes. There's something going on here. When European explorers first started coming over to the Americas, there were some people who lived there who had never seen Europeans and never seen ships. And they were unable to see ships because they'd never seen them. But they saw the wake of the ship. They saw where the ship was moving through the water. They had seen a lot of water. They lived by the water. They were coastal people. And so they saw how the shape of the water was strange. They were literally unable to see the ship, which was there, making the shape in the water at first. But they noticed this weird shape in the water, you know, the V that comes behind. And they kept with their little doubt of like, what's that? It's not like a big dolphin. It's not that playful. And then they started to be able to see the ship. Not quite in time to do anything about what was coming. But. So leaving room for this little doubt, so Indra has this little doubt, like, what we see reflected in the water can't be Atman. So he also still has forgotten that the actual teaching isn't that. It's what is in the eye that we see with. Is there any question or anything to say yet? So this little doubt and how that starts to kind of jiggle us is a lot like when we notice that our leg is asleep. And so sometimes then we might willingly or unwillingly make some kind of movement because we've noticed that something's funny. And then what comes next is weird. It can feel separate from me. It can be quite intense with extremes. And our system doesn't know what to do with the information. In fact, if we think of it as the nerve has been pressed and unallowed to travel the information, so to speak, the system itself isn't ready to tell us what's happening. But we know something's happening. And with that little shift in response to feeling nothing and noticing that I feel nothing, where there might be something, maybe there's something there. And then we move. And then, whoa. Delicious and excruciating, hot and cold, etc. All exactly what we said about the physical thing. And part of that contrast is that we're dying to know what's happening. And so then we think we know, we think we don't know. We think we know, we think we don't know. So Indra's process is like that. Like the reflection in the water. And he can't quite remember that it was about the eye, something about the eye. But he does reach a conclusion that what was reflected to him from the water couldn't be Atman. So he goes back to Prajapati, good move, and says, I'm still confused. I don't yet understand. So this might be going to a person, or it might be going to your favorite tree, or it might be going really deep inside, or whatever movement seems called for. But going back sort of as deep as we can, or where we feel the source of things is happening. And know that we're confused. And so then Indra stays with the Lord of Creation for 32 years. And then another 32 years. So just, we get impatient with 3 days, no? 3 hours even, 3 minutes sometimes. And it is only natural because there is that weird time zone that we get into when there's numbness that's coming back to life. It doesn't really take that long, but it seems like it's taking way too long. But luckily, we can't do much else but be with it. So after each 32 years, he kept realizing he didn't get it, which is big. Only at the end of 101 years, Indra finally realized Atman. So the importance of staying with that not understanding. And understanding that the process of not understanding, but something is moving towards understanding. So it's like utterly humble. And at the same time, in the face of 32 years, 5 years without a word, which is true, that's really true. there's 5 years without a word from some places in us. Not a word. And this utter confidence also, which is not like me confident in me, though it does come to me that after a while, which is good. That we gain a simple confidence in little things, like that we can find our way today. We can make a best guess today, and it is good enough. But there's a way that once we've noticed that the leg is asleep and maybe some shift has happened, or even when without a shift, we're kind of onto something, the way that Indra, it's kind of unstoppable in a way. So it's not even that I need to really be that confident in my own ability, but life is taking place. And even if I fold my leg again and say, never mind, there's still not a way out. So even when we're overwhelmed with dense doubt, the little doubt keeps going somehow. And if we can recognize which is our friend, and that kind of friendship where even when we hate that little doubt and we just shut up. There's no ship. It's a dolphin. It's the wind. The way that little doubt keeps coming up is also another kind of trust. So we think of trust as being up here and finding a way that I trust you to do what I want you to do, essentially. And this is not a willing trust. This is not like I decide to trust. I may not even want to. But I find that this is happening and I'm in it. And I notice that there's no way out. And there's no way back. And there's no hurry forward. And at some point, all of our energy that wants to get out of there can't anymore. And then it's sort of simple. We remember that what the teacher said was the eye, not the dress, not the reflection. Sometimes I like the metaphor of staying underwater, as if we could learn how to breathe underwater. So like we go down deep into ourselves, and then the way we think of ourselves is then we come back up for air, where we can come up to the head and sort of get an understanding of what's happening, and then we feel okay, but now we can go back down. But there's a way that it's that the reverse image is better as well. We actually like dip down where we don't belong and where we can't breathe, in the dense doubt. And then we have to come up for air, where we do belong and where we can breathe, and where life happens all along. So we can let the sort of reference points change. We think of ourselves as being like heady, unevolved people who are doing our best and working on ourselves. And every once in a while we visit depth and stillness and peace and awakening. And that, but then we're back in real life. And at some point that is a joke, to think of ourselves that way. One of my teachers says that our circulation is our age. Our age is how our circulation is. Speaking partly of the body. And she's not talking about trying to be like living longer or living forever. It's about the quality of life, that there can be a natural renewal during our lifetime. That we're not living in a way that burns us out. And sometimes we feel a kind of natural progression of, as we rest, that we can start to feel freshness circulating both superficially and deeply. And it seems to have its own way of finding harmony. But it's not that we necessarily want to bring more circulation everywhere to everything. So it's not that we want to give more food to dense doubt. When our approach to meditation and to resting and to being alive has an innocence to it, so we're not veering off of the natural unfolding according to an ideal, like we hear circulation. Okay, we got to circulate it everywhere. When the innocence is there, there is an unfolding that's happy. Not always pleasant. But usually we do veer off according to our ideas of how it should be, what we're supposed to be doing, and what results there should be. And then too quickly we take up an answer like Vairochana did. Rumi tells a story of a guy who was getting bored with his life and his practice and feeling poor. And wanting to like be a conqueror of some kind. And he saw this really big snake out in the mountains on his walk. And it was completely unmoving. And even sort of tied up in a knot. And the guy thinks, cool, a big dead snake. I bet if I take that into town, people will pay money to see it and they'll think that I'm amazing, that I killed this dragon. I'll go down in history and all. This is like Vairochana going to the demons and saying, yeah, what you see reflected in the water, that's it. And so he carries it out of the cold, snowy mountains into the hot town. And people do come, of course. Of course we do. People of all different classes come. And Rumi really describes, like, shoulder to shoulder, everybody wants to see it. The rich and the poor, like, all in there. Young and old. And this guy, from his poverty, and trying to get a quick answer has a responsibility here for wanting people to come and think how great he is. So in the heat of the town, the snake, of course, wakes up and devours half of the people before they can get away. So when we speak about aliveness, it's a word. And like every word, it has its drawbacks. It's not that we want to bring more aliveness everywhere. And so if we find ourselves looking for an edge of intensity to give us a sense of orientation, so to give us a feeling that we're doing good, we've got an answer. At least we have an edge. Yeah? Watch out. When we know that we have our innocence, we can go straight. When we know that we have not our innocence and we are distracted by ideals and we feel poor and we want something to hold on to, some quick result, some sense of orientation, where am I? And we can notice that happening in the connections with other people where when the certain person's in the room, you definitely feel yourself as something lower or higher or friendly or on defense or whatever. And who would you be without that? So we can be open to what we don't know and to what we don't see and to what we don't hear. We can feel that movement of non-listening or non-feeling. And we can let life come back in, but not with an idea of how it should be, of how life should come back in. This Christian mystic, Bernadette Roberts, that I've been mentioning one time along her way, after having a lot of deep experiences, she noticed that when she was around people, she would say really weird things suddenly that she hadn't meant to say. And it was kind of cool, but she didn't really know what it was. And so she made a decision. In her case, she had a bit of a forcefulness sometimes. And she said that she understood from the time that she was a child that whatever could be taken away, in her words, was not from God. And so she would be better without it. In the words of other traditions, it would be like, what comes and goes is not real, or what comes and goes is not worth holding on to. But she sort of went on a mission to find out, and she got the sense that whatever these energies were that would suddenly take over, mostly when she was with other people. Would be like put out like a candle if they didn't get food. if they came from God, so to say, if they weren't taking energy from her, so to say, then they could continue without nourishment from her. And so she noticed what gave them power, what gave power to this weird thing that would take over. And she noticed it was her spiritual practice was a big one. So for her, walking in nature, writing in her journal, being quiet, praying, studying, and then also being around other people was another place. And so she just decided, however long it would take, she wouldn't do any of those things, which for her was a terrible thing, to go without all of her beloved parts of her day, for she didn't know how long. And of course, when she started, it got more powerful. She said it was like a pressure cooker. It was like putting the lid on a pot so it gets hotter. But she felt, she could feel also from the beginning, a lessening at the same time as it was intensifying. And after 1 week, she could feel that it was dying out. And after 2 weeks, it was finished. So it's a little bit like that moving the leg. It can seem to take forever. It might take 101 years, but probably it won't. At least those times where there's, we're really checking something out with the little doubt. And then there was a much more mature and deep peace and stillness with her from then on. We also can, through our ways of relating to each other, even in silence, how there's relating. From an inward place, we can notice how relating happens. And that can help also give us some signs. It can give us something that, that orbit is funny, that movement in the water is, never seen that before. To start to know more about what we don't see and know in ourselves. So like psychologically, the shadow. What we judge in other people. Also what we feel inspired by in other people. So it's really a curious phenomenon that many times we might see someone and feel really inspired by their gentleness or their stillness or their aliveness or whatever. For us, it's maybe an important quality that's starting to wake up. Whereas for that person, it might be really an old defense mechanism to be so gentle all the time, or to stay really still, or to be really nice, or to be really alive. It's really curious. So we can kind of learn without the extra projection of how great you are that you're so still. But like, wow, stillness really moves me. Stillness wants to wake up a bit here. Or and sometimes when we do invite that seeing of what we hadn't seen, listening to what we hadn't listened to, being allowed to be what had not been allowed, we just let there be a slowness to that. May it take 101 years. Just a simple gesture of, normally I would move, what if I stay? Or normally I would stay still, what if I move? The simplest gesture possible, probably. Into what's not allowed. But with that little doubt, that's the utterly humble, like, I know I don't understand. So we're not, it's not like we're being heroic, like, now I'm going to always move, or now I'm going to always be still. We don't need to drag the snake into town yet. Number 7 from 2004. So this book, for those of you who've just come, is called Sabbaths. Well, it's actually called This Day, Collected and New Sabbath Poems. So Wendell Berry, a couple of decades ago, came out with this very small book called Sabbaths. So Day of Rest, Days of Rest. And it's nice that the now new and collected Sabbath poems, collected and new Sabbath poems, is called This Day. So it's moving even further from any structure, just like this day, day of rest. This is number 7 from 2004, and it is for a woman, or in honor of a woman named D. Rice Amos, I think is how you say it. So it says number 7, and then it says D. Rice Amos. A little too small for my 46-year-old eyes. 1920 to 2004. A gracious lady came to us and favored us by receiving kindly our care of her at the end of all her days. Which is lovely to have that nested in a book about days of rest. So she's dying and she's gracious. And it sounds so small to be gracious in our care of her in her last days. But I don't know if you've been with anyone who's dying. It's so hard. It can be so hard to accept that love. And so especially to feel where the non-listening, the places where we're non-listeners, that sometimes it's simply fear of being loved. And how it hurts to be loved. And it doesn't have to be fear, so the word aversion, turning away from. There's a turning away from. So in the yoga class, there's this turning away from going into that particular posture really at all. So just non-listening to warrior pose instructions or whatever. And feeling where there's the non-turning towards, the non-opening, the non-circulation, receiving love, or loving. And sometimes those can feel like two steps, maybe one comes before the other, in a different order for each of us. Being loved, and then realizing also, loving is a whole other. And then is it? Is it actually just the front of the ship and the back of the ship? Similarly, the fear or the aversion, the fear of the aversion. It's curious we say aversion to. The turning away motion towards. It's funny, it's a kind of a good clue because there is like that. That what we turn from, we're also holding to. And then it's the snake. So just feeling where there is a non-turning towards, a non-openness to, a non-feeling of, a non-feeling of being loved, even when we are being loved, a non-feeling of loving, even when that is actually happening, a non-feeling of being seen or seeing. And again, both, it's two tremendous things, to be seen and also to see. Rumi talks about someone who is free of all of our dynamics and can throw his or her gaze around as they wish. The non-openness to being heard and to hearing, being met. Meeting, being included and including. It's two tremendous, they're both tremendous. To be included is tremendous. Tremendous. And then to realize the power of including is also tremendous. So here is D, dying in 2004, 10 years ago. A gracious lady came to us and favored us by receiving kindly our care of her at the end of all her days. This man is amazing, as is this woman. She was a lady made graceful beyond what we had known by the welcome she gave to death, her guest, when she made whom? I'm gonna have to bring my torch at 6 o'clock in the evening. Oh my gosh. She was a lady made graceful beyond what we had known by the welcome she gave to death, her guest, whom she made unfearful by her fearlessness, having no further use for herself as we had known her. Wah. The Indian music, wah. And in Spain they say ole, which comes from Allah. May we and all beings be peaceful in and amongst all beings, inwardly and outwardly peaceful. May we be. May our lives and our practice be dedicated to the unfolding of liberation for all.